Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lindstrom's here. We talk about something really cool, using social media to empower people to solve problems. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 308, recorded September 10th, 2014. Crisis.net. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Sunhinge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and totally unaware of it, projects you may have never heard of and go, hey, that's cool, I want to go play with that. Joining me this week is Dan Lynch. Welcome back to the show, Dan.
Hey, it's good to be here. It's always a pleasure.
And it's good to be back at the mic. I've been gone for a couple of weeks on a cruise. I'll talk a little bit about that at the end of the show here. But the show's not about you and me. Well, wait, where are you speaking to us from?
Yeah, I'm calling from Liverpool in the UK, up in the northwest where it's not so sunny. And we're finally coming into winter, I think, now already. That's the way it goes, I suppose.
Cool. And those of you that are watching the live video feed also know that I am not in the normal spot down in Santa Monica. I'm back at home for this week. I had to recover from the cruise for a few days. That's always how it works. And so we're coming to you live from Beaverton, Oregon, my apartment bedroom. Ah, cool. Awesome. Awesome. Alrighty. So let's talk a little about today's show. Today we have Jonathan Morgan, who's going to be talking to us about Ushahidi, which I mispronounced a dozen of times in the last few weeks, and also crisis.net. Now, I saw Jonathan give a talk at OSCON, I think it was about 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago, somewhere down in there, and I was really moved by what these guys are doing. It's a series of projects that are all looking at the social streams, like Flickr, Instagram, Twitter, and that stuff, and then analyzing the data, aggregating the data, and doing it using an open source technology. And open source technologies, I should say, in plural, and are already providing really good real-time information about various crises going on. Jonathan, in particular, is the CTO. No, he's focused on the CrisisNet side of it, so I'm sure he'll have more to say about that, but I'm also going to get him to talk a little about his presentation about Ushahidi overall. So I'm really looking forward to the show because it was I'm always someone who looks for practical social things that can be done with open source software, not just practical thing. Well, still practical to help people out, but I mean, you know what I'm saying. Dan, what do you know about this so far?
It looks like a really, really important project, as you said. I mean, sometimes as geeks and techie people, we play with things just because we think it's cool, and that's great. Obviously, that's fantastic, but sometimes you get a chance to make a difference, and that seems like these guys are really making a difference, and I think that's really good.
Well, we might as well get right into the show. Let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Very cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm coming to you from Austin, Texas.
And I bet that's a bit hot right now, huh?
Yeah, this is the time of year when we all just grin and bear it until we can get back to the cooler weather.
Yeah. You know, I was surprised. I was just on a 14-day cruise up to Alaska, and it was pretty much 65 or 70 at every one of the ports except one. And so I'm like, wow, this is not usual. This is pretty crazy. Anyway, this is not this week in weather. So let's go ahead and can you give us the 30,000-foot view by kind of describing and whatever sort of relationship you want to talk about in terms of Ushahidi and crisis.net, however you think one would explain the other or whatever. What a long question, but take it from there.
No, it's cool. So Ushahidi is a technology company, and we make a variety of technology products for social good. We also do strategic consulting, kind of anything that we can get our hands in that uses technology to make the world a better place, frankly. And then CrisisNet is a project that I work on, and we're focused specifically on that gap between people taking action on data and actually collecting the data in the first place. Because I think even though with the for-profit space, we're all, you know, we're really used to having data at our fingertips. We can do all sorts of interesting things with it. We hire a data scientist and we predict the future. But in the humanitarian space and just the social good space in general, it's a little bit behind the curve. There's some challenges that are keeping people from using the data effectively. So that's what we're focused on CrisisNet.
Sure. And you were talking at the OSCON about this sort of ability to aggregate social networks. Can you talk more about that and how that contributes to all those derivatives that you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So about social media in particular, there's a challenge in finding data when it comes to understanding a crisis. So a natural disaster or a conflict, it's usually tucked all over the place. So there's a lot of organizations that have some operational data, like people working on the ground, NGOs, governments, things like this. But it's difficult to get access to the information that they have, either because they don't know how to release it, or because it's sensitive, or just because nobody thought that it would be of value to anybody. They haven't quite reached the stage where people just accept that data is inherently useful. And so social media is fantastic because not only is it publicly available most of the time, but it is direct reports from people that are on the ground experiencing a natural disaster or a conflict. So the work that we were doing in particular around Syria was focused on all of the different, like there's a large number of different factions operating in Syria right now. The government, rebel groups, and the rebel groups are sort of segmented into a number of different organizations. And so it's a little bit difficult to know who's who, but each of these different organizations is self-promoting using Facebook pages and YouTube channels, just like kind of normal everyday organizations. And so based on the feed of information that they're putting out and the comments and the different ways that people are interacting with these organizations online, we found that you could get a pretty clear picture of what was happening on the ground just by tracking this kind of open data.
So you're saying you're primarily getting information from people who are self-announced to be someone who tracks that kind of boots on the ground stuff, or are you gathering more stuff from random tweets and Facebook posts and things like that?
It's a little bit of both. So I think the big fish, like the whale, is being able to look at the massive stream of social media data, like Twitter data, for instance, and find the needle in the haystack, find that one tweet amongst the noise that says, there's gunshots around the corner from me. And it's somebody that doesn't normally post about this kind of thing. Normally, they're talking about the kind of music they listen to or the food they ate for breakfast, like all the stuff that the rest of us post on social media. But today, they got caught up in some kind of conflict and they need to let their friends know or their community know that it's happening. We're approaching that problem. And then the shortcut to it is identifying people who have sort of gained a reputation for being active in a particular conflict or disaster, either because they are a person of note who happened to be in that situation, or they're an organization that is kind of a player in the conflict or the disaster recovery.
Like, you'd probably never pick me because most of my posts to Instagram are either Insta-food or Insta-weather, and so it's probably not very useful to anybody. But I do occasionally, like I feel an earthquake when I'm in California or something. I'm posting about something that is a live event there. One of the ways that was sort of invented to help out this out is the use of hashtags, but then you have the problem of identifying the proper hashtag to aggregate the data. Are you working on that part of the problem too?
Yeah, just that exactly. So being able to, so there's two aspects to this problem. There's actually sucking in the data and the technology tools that can suck in information from lots of different sources. And then there's understanding where to point that big sucker, if that makes sense. So identifying kind of the part of the social media spectrum, whether it's a certain set of hashtags or a certain set of users that are known to be relevant to a particular natural disaster, for example, is definitely part of the problem that we're trying to solve. The hashtag thing is great, actually, in particular for natural disasters, like you mentioned, like when an earthquake happens or when a hurricane's coming. What's kind of cool is that you're seeing even municipalities and disaster relief organizations promoting a particular hashtag so that everybody who wants to be communicating in public and sharing information and sharing resources around disaster relief is all using the same hashtag because it's being coordinated by a body that has, you know, kind of domain over the relief effort. And so that's kind of exciting to see, is that it's a little bit less organic, a little bit less from the ground up, which can make it difficult to do the kind of work we're doing. Just that little bit of effort from these agencies to engage with people where they already communicate, I think, is making a big difference.
And we have a question from the chat room. Can Jonathan comment on how ethics and privacy are viewed by your company?
Yeah, I think that these are really important questions. In particular, with a lot of this data that is very sensitive. And so we've been in discussion with some organizations that do relief work on the ground to combat Ebola, for example. And there's both a real need for identifying areas in which Ebola is spreading and the rate at which it's spreading, but also obviously some serious privacy concerns, because identifying an individual who has Ebola in an area, or an area even just discussing that online and making it publicly available how quickly the disease is spreading in a particular part of the world has drawbacks for that community. And so it is a tough tightrope to walk. In terms of the social media data that we work with, typically we're working with data that's already public. And so the goal is, this sort of first wave is to take data that's already public and get some more value out of it, some kind of aggregate understanding of what the community's saying or the direction in which they're moving, as opposed to sort of extracting data that should be private and then making it public. So, because on the one hand, we have this belief that, you know, crisis data is a right, like it's a human right for people to have access to the data that's generated about them in these sorts of situations. But at the same time, because of the sorts of data that we're working with, it's inherently sensitive. And so we're not quite at the stage where we're making those hard choices about should this data be public or not. We're mostly working with data that people have already self-elected to make public.
So speaking of the social media, how do you drink from the fire hose? This sounds like an incomprehensible problem. How do you absorb all the feeds that you might be subscribed to or maybe getting the full feed and process it in anything that resembles something in the next day or two?
Well, we typically focus on cutting the stream down into more manageable chunks. So like we were just talking about, we focus on a particular group of users or a certain set of hashtags and just ingest that information only, as opposed to ingesting the entire Twitter fire hose and then going through the process of filtering it and manipulating it within our system. Because, you know, any system that does that has to be able to handle the capacity of Twitter from the ground up, which is possible, but I think further down the road for us. We released our public beta in June, and so for us, the first couple months are definitely about proving out the capacity of the system or proving out the usefulness and the utility of this kind of product, as opposed to diving right in and consuming, drinking from the trough.
Okay, cool. And so what? Be a little more specific. What kind of technologies are you using? You must be using RSS readers and fast processing, maybe some NoSQL data, things like that. Can you talk a little about the technology behind this?
Yeah, absolutely. So we built a little ETL pipeline, a data extraction and transformation pipeline. And so we built it with a handful of open source technologies. There, we used Python for most of the scripting, and so it's easy for people that have an understanding of a data source to both instruct our system where that data can be retrieved and then teach our system how that data needs to be transformed so it lives within a common format throughout our system. We store information about the sources of data that we're retrieving in MongoDB, and then we use Elasticsearch as the primary search engine. So because the important thing for us is that we don't make a lot of judgments about the data that's coming into the system, is that we ingest it and then give the end user a lot of power to query that data however it makes the most sense for the analysis or the application that they're building. So we try and index all the information that we can inside Elasticsearch and then expose the very powerful query syntax that technology provides for getting access to the data in just the way that you need it. So Python, MongoDB, Elasticsearch, we have a little processing pipeline, again, that uses a lot of the great natural language processing and machine learning tools that the Python community has made available. The natural language toolkit, for example, is a miracle descended from the heavens and gives the power of natural language processing to mere mortals like me who are just, you know, software engineers.
So, Jonathan, I'm curious to know about how, given the areas that you're working in and the data is coming from, how does connectivity affect this? Because I would imagine, obviously, in turbulent areas, there's going to be problems with people getting connection and so on. Do you have any kind of ways to deal with that?
Yeah, that's actually also an important problem to be considering when you're working in parts of the world where the telecom infrastructure is less developed, or regions that are experiencing some kind of disaster or conflict that interrupt the telecom infrastructure. And so on the CrisisNet side, because we're working with data that's already been collected, we generally don't get that far along. We don't really address that part of the problem. But Ushahidi, the mapping platform that we built, the crowdsourced mapping platform, that the organization is really most famous for. And so just for people that don't know, it's a tool that lets people do crowdsourced reporting. So if I'm monitoring elections that might be disputed and there's likely to be violence, I can make an instance of this tool publicly available, and anybody who sees intimidation or violence at a polling station or wherever can report it through Ushahidi, and then we put that information on a map so that people can understand the way that that crisis is evolving. And so the way that we get around some of the network issues for Ushahidi is that we rely heavily on SMS for people being able to submit reports, which is often the primary mechanism, the primary like digital communication mechanism in a lot of these parts of the world. So we use SMS pretty heavily. And then there's another project that actually just spun out of Ushahidi that we incubated called The Brick. And anybody who was at OSCON and came by to talk to us probably saw it. It's actually a router that works anywhere. So it kind of does that last mile of connectivity in parts of the world where it's really difficult to get online. And it does seamless transitions between Wi-Fi, 3G networks. It gives you a lot of power to choose the, even down to the choosing the cell tower, which gives you the strongest signal when you're trying to get online and either post some information or just kind of give some information about what's happening around you.
And is this, it sounds like you're kind of generally centrally hosting this kind of stuff, or do people run their own, you mentioned instances, do people usually spin up their own instance of one of the products or one of the tools locally, or are they posting the data back to you? I imagine you need the data centrally if you're going to analyze it properly.
It's a bit of both. So the Ushahidi product can be spun up on a per instance basis. So that's kind of very similar to a WordPress type architecture, where we have a version that you can run in the cloud and you can spin up an instance that way. Or if you're a little bit more comfortable technically, then you can take the software, download it, and run it on your own servers. What we've found is that most people who run it on their own servers actually make the data available through a public API. And so our platform, CrisisNet, does centrally host a lot of this data, and we can retrieve it from all of the different Ushahidi instances that have been deployed around the world. So we retrieve that data from their API, we put it into our system, and then once we've combined it all into a single source, then we can do all sorts of interesting things, like what do people talk about when they deploy an Ushahidi instance? In fact, we did kind of a straightforward sentiment analysis to try and validate the assumption that people either were or weren't complaining all the time when they reported in some kind of conflict or disaster situation. So like, does the only reporting that happen when a flood has occurred in your town, are people complaining about the lack of response effort, or are they talking about the positive ways in which community members are helping one another? And we found that it actually worked out about half and half, which was kind of fun. But in any case, it's a little bit of both. It kind of depends on what the needs of the product are.
Excellent. So, yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, some kind of federation, or I suppose aggregation would be the word. It sounds like you've got that quite well covered already.
Yeah, that's definitely a significant part of the data problem. And that was the impetus behind CrisisNet in general, is that you have companies like Ushahidi that are making technologies that let people generate a lot of personal data. People are taken to social media. And then there really are NGOs who do great work on the ground. They have lots of interesting data, and sometimes they even go about releasing it. Both small little NGOs, all the way up through like massive agencies like the UN, the part of the UN that oversees refugee migration, UNHCR. They actually released refugee camp data through a JSON API, which I think seems kind of straightforward and obvious to most of us, but I think it represents a serious shift in the way that data is being made available from some of these larger organizations. So just being able to combine all of those different data sources in one place and get some kind of insight into what that data says is really why we started doing this in the first place.
And given the way you're kind of aggregating data and getting stuff in, is there any implication for security of somebody trying to overload the system or some distributed denial of service or something like that? I don't know if that has ever come up or there's any kind of problems with that kind of thing.
It's yet to come up in terms of the data that we're consuming, because the data that we're consuming is under our control. We don't have a push mechanism, for example, for pushing data into the system. It's only pull. So we have a data source and then we pull it periodically. And so we're in control over how much we receive. On the front end, it's definitely a concern. Right now, the API is accessible for anybody that has an API key. It's meant to be publicly available. And so we've yet to see the kind of you know, like a DDoS attack, for example. But it is something I think, in particular, as the platform becomes more high profile, that we'll need to contend with.
And how about false data? How would you deal with that kind of thing? Because I'm sure, and it's probably not a major occurrence right now, but I'm just thinking, if for some reason I was, you know, in an oppressive regime and I decide I want to stop people from getting a message out, I could run, you know, a load of scripted instances firing off false data saying everything's great here and, you know, muddying the picture a little bit. Is there any way to figure that out or filter through that?
Yeah, I think that is, well, I mean, you talked about it in terms of instances of our software that people might deploy, but I think that happens now, especially in social media. Organizations like ISIS, for example, have been very, it sounds strange to say it this way, but they've been very savvy about the way that they've manipulated social media to paint a particular picture of a conflict. And we take a relatively agnostic perspective about what truth looks like as data comes through our system. From the perspective that we try not to be the arbiters of truth or the arbiters of valuable conflict data. So if information is false, it might actually be interesting to somebody to do analysis on the amount of false information or the way in which false information is disseminated. That said, we have been developing technologies that do that do some kind of analysis on the information to give the user more data, more knowledge, like kind of more metadata about what the information that they're consuming might be. For example, is the information that you're consuming very subjective? Is it very objective and kind of rating that score? And even that simple kind of sentiment objectivity analysis gives people some kind of indication or some kind of like querying filter that they can use to say, if I'm only looking for objective data from a particular part of the world, I can filter for under those criteria. If I'm actually interested in looking for highly polarized information, I can filter for that type of filter with those constraints as well. So a lot of people talk about the verification problem, and I think it's hugely important, but it's also hugely important in context, if that makes sense. And so it's hard for us as this kind of, Switzerland of data to impose a lot of context on the data that's coming through our system.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it must be quite a challenge. I mean, another thing I was curious about is you talked about the collection and the analysis of the data and stuff that you're doing. Is that in private, or can anyone get access to that kind of model and use it? Is it for sale? How does that work?
Yeah, it's actually completely public. So the analysis that we've been doing, we publish on our blog. Or the analyses that we've been doing, we publish on our blog. The technologies that's used to manipulate the data as it comes through our processing pipeline is all up on GitHub. As is the technology that we use to retrieve and transform the data in the first place. So it's a totally open public project. And then for people that are interested in doing their own analysis, the data that we consume and transform is made available through a public API. So it's definitely a platform that we hope encourages people to really dig in and do their own work with the data, as opposed to just relying on us as, you know, kind of the data scientists on high, you know, disseminating knowledge to everybody. It's much more that we would prefer to have that kind of point level data, that crowdsourced from the ground data that lets people make their own connections.
And I saw that API keys are free. Is there any kind of limit to how many requests I can make with the API keys and stuff?
Not yet. I mean, in the event and for a reasonable number of requests, that'll always be free. We reserve the right that, I guess, if the UN or like a security agency or something is making thousands of requests an hour because that they're doing some kind of more profit driven analysis, then that's a discussion that we can have. But if I think for the average kind of everyday developer or data scientist who's interested in kind of a small scale analysis, which is really what we're hoping for. I mean, you see this kind of analysis from huge financial institutions, kind of big data mining companies, but you don't really see the kind of weekend developer looking for a project to do in their spare time. Maybe they have a startup idea that's data driven, but instead they focus on something that kind of piggybacks on the Instagram API and lets you share photos with friends at a concert or something like this. And those apps are great, but what we're hoping is that by making it free and making it accessible, that we're encouraging just that sort of developer to take that spare time, take that side project, and focus on something that has a real social impact.
And is there any cost for you guys? I mean, financial cost in working with the likes of Twitter and Facebook? Do you have to pay for any of those kind of searches that you do, or any of that data that you're doing from the other end, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, there could be. At the moment, there's not. We don't need to pay for firehose access with Twitter, for example. Facebook mm-hmm. is actually a supporter of the project, so there aren't any financial implications there. We do have some hosting costs, and obviously Chris Albin, the project co-founder, and I work on it full-time. But we are grant-funded, so we have a long runway to continue doing this kind of work and to be improving the system and hosting the data for some time to come.
Excellent. I would imagine with a project that's so clearly in the social good, you know, serving a good purpose, social purpose, I would hope that, you know, companies would support it, but that's not always the case. Can you tell us a bit more about the Facebooks? But how did they kind of come into that? Did they just approach you? Did you approach them? How does that kind of thing work?
Yeah, actually, because Ushahidi has been a relatively high-profile technology provider for humanitarian work for a number of years now. We have, and some of our co-founders are, you know, TED speakers, and they also are, they made some high-level connections at Facebook and were able to pitch the idea to them. And that was a big part of getting that organization on board. So I think, like everybody else, I mean, you know, Facebook is really interested they're aware that the data that they have is very valuable and potentially very powerful for solving some social good problems. And I think for these large organizations, it's about finding the right channel, finding the right organizations to partner with to make sure that that data is used responsibly to really move forward, you know, an agenda with significant, an agenda that will have some significant impact. In fact, you know, we talk to a lot of organizations like this that they might have a lot of reach or they might have a lot of data. But, you know, Google, Twitter, Facebook, for political reasons, obviously, it's difficult for them to share information with one another, even though with their powers combined, that could be really significant. And so it's important, I think, for organizations like ours to fill that gap. And like I kind of joked about before, you know, being the Switzerland for this type of data to find a way to house the information so that everybody can use it in a way that doesn't make it difficult for them to, you know, pursue their primary objective, which is making money.
And I suppose, yeah, in some ways you're kind of helping them analyze their data as well, and it's available to them just as it's available to everyone else. So there is that, you know, advantage that you're performing a service for them as well. I was just curious in relation to a former guest on this show, actually, a project that some friends of mine are involved with called Scraper Wiki, which is actually more kind of screen scraping and getting government data that way. They've recently had problems with Twitter. Twitter basically switched off their access with no warning or no reason, and they, even the offer of large amounts of money did not seem to sway Twitter in any way as to, you know, opening it up again. Is that any kind of worry for you guys, or is that something that you kind of deal with when you get to it, I suppose?
I mean, and from a practical perspective, it's a deal with it when we get to it kind of issue. But absolutely. I mean, I think particularly a platform like Twitter that makes its data public and is moving in a direction that is where they recognize the value of their data and they are restricting its use to things that are only profit driven. It is a concern. It's a concern for organizations like ours and especially lots of, you know, smaller developers, even for-profit product companies that have made, suites of products on top of Twitter's APIs that are now finding their businesses in jeopardy because of some of those policies changing. I mean, it is a concern. I think for us right now, it's not a problem that I see coming up in the short term. And, you know, we'd have to address it when we get there. And we've had some conversations with Twitter's team about the way in which their API should be used and, what might be available to an organization like ours. And I think those discussions were productive. But at the same time, you know, it is right now they hold a very valuable stream of data that everybody wants access to. And I think it'll indicate what kind of company they want to be as they start to make choices about who gets to use that data and in what way.
And that kind of leads nicely into something else I wanted to ask about. So what kind of people are using the data right now? And what kind of, you know, uses have you seen for it that are really interesting?
Yeah, most of the response so far has been from data journalists. And so that's been exciting because it's a group of people that really understands how to take something really thorny and complex like like conflict data, and find the story in the data and really communicate it to people that probably aren't data scientists, they're probably not academics, but it really helps illustrate the way that, you know, a conflict evolves over time. And so that's been a really exciting community to work with. They really are at the sweet spot, kind of right on the wave of this idea of, you know, data analysis becoming part of the mainstream, which is, I think, still relatively new. So that's been exciting. And I think, like I was saying before, for us, what I'm hoping the next group will be, the next wave, are both people who are kind of those like weekend developers looking for side projects to really make this a more crowdsourced effort for finding data that people find valuable and doing kind of small scale analyses. And then on the CrisisNet side, the features that we're actually developing in-house are focused a lot more on that kind of quasi-technical user, somebody who might not be able to, you know, write 500 lines of code, but understands the value of data, understands the story that they might tell, and maybe has access to data because they're more of a decision maker in an organization. So, you know, the director of whatever at an NGO who knows the data that she has can pull it into our system and visualize it in a way that lets her understand it in exactly the way that, you know, that we've been doing with the data that we've been ingesting, but that doesn't require, you know, the technical expertise that I think has been a hurdle for a lot of these decision makers.
And that's something that leads, you almost answered the question I was going to ask, which is what kind of interfaces are people using? Because, I mean, obviously there's a lot of non-technical users who are going to be looking at this kind of stuff. And do they have like a web interface that they can use to just analyze a certain area, or how does that kind of thing work?
Well, not yet. That was sort of our...
Okay.
The assumption that we made going in was that this would be mostly a product for technical people. And so we exposed an API. You know, we had a little Node.js web app that was consuming the data from, or that was exposing the data that sat in our Elasticsearch data store. And then developers could query that API and then use whatever they wanted to visualize that information. I know Chris, the project co-founder, and I have been using a lot of different tools to do just that, to kind of demonstrate the utility of the platform. He works a lot with Pandas and sort of Python's data science suite. I've been working a lot using JavaScript technologies, like D3 is the big one that everybody uses for visualizing this type of information. And that's been great. And what we're now doing is taking the tools that we've been using and exposing them in a web interface so that somebody who's less technical can do the same kind of analysis without having, you know, spent the bulk of their career in a text editor writing Python.
Yeah, I mean, that must be a challenge because we want to lower the barriers for people to get into this. And you know, as you mentioned before, not everyone's going to be able to write 500 lines of code to make this work. So it sounds like a really good idea. So, in terms of user base, and so I don't know if you can really answer this or something, but is there a wide adoption going on? Are you seeing a good adoption of the service?
Yes and no, frankly, and that's what led us to focus on the features that we've been integrating into the system more recently and that we'll be releasing over the next couple months. We're seeing a lot of interest and a lot of excitement, a lot of people registering to use the platform, which has been exciting. A lot of people giving a lot of attention to the analysis that Chris and I have been publishing based on the data that we've consumed, but that sort of that middle ground where we actually saw people who'd registered actually use the system to produce something valuable isn't where we'd like it to be. And that's what led to a lot of the decision making over the past week or two, where we've been looking at the next iteration of the product and the feature sets that we'll be releasing. So it's been a little bit of both. I mean, it's been really encouraging. I think what's good to know is that this really is a problem we're solving, that there really are a lot of people that recognize that this data is valuable and know that the humanitarian community in particular is still coming up short in terms of the ways that they're using that data to make decisions. But the number of people who are technical, interested in humanitarian problems, and available has not been large enough to justify leaving the product at this kind of API-only access. The sort of platform as a service might not be the right model for this type of data yet. So we'll get everybody there. We'll get everybody over the hump. We'll teach them a little bit about data science. We'll get people to engage with data a little bit more. And then I think after that wave, the kind of that raw API access where people are dealing with the data directly, I think might be a little bit more popular. So we'll see. It's been a really solid couple months. of learning. And we've been in touch with a lot of really smart people who I think are going to be instrumental in making sure that the platform continues to evolve in the way that it'll be helpful to the largest number of people.
And what about development of this and so on? I mean, how many people are working on the project, and what about your contributions from the community and so on? It sounds like you've got a good buy-in. You mentioned the Facebook thing. I'm sure many other companies are contributing. Is there a lot of code coming in and ideas and so on?
Yeah, actually, there's been a lot of people on both ends, particularly now that we're moving more towards visualizing and building interfaces around the data. We've had a lot of positive contributions from that sort of developer. And it's a little bit, you know, those technologies are very sexy right now. Everybody wants to code an app with Angular and D3, and that's great. I mean, we're really happy to have that kind of help. And then from the data science perspective, kind of from the processing pipeline as it exists, we've had people that were interested in building, you know, clients for their favorite programming language, which I think is a great way to get involved. There's a pretty easy to use JSON-based API, and then just wrapping that in some simple PHP classes or Ruby classes or Python classes or whatever it is that, you know, kind of makes that a little bit more accessible to developers that are familiar with a certain part of the stack is really exciting. So that's been where we've seen the most interest so far. And that's for CrisisNet. I think in terms of community engagement, the Ushahidi platform, that installable mapping platform that's PHP-based, has always had a really strong developer community. People, you know, contributing new features and themes, and they've been around for a few more years, and so that's really wide. And what we're seeing, I think, is people that are starting to see that there's other ways to get involved with us as an organization if you're interested in contributing your time and contributing code.
Mm-hmm. I want to circle back for a minute and make sure everybody's aware of how this project got started, and how did Ushahidi in particular get started, and then when was CrisisNet brought in, and when did you come in?
Sure. Well, Ushahidi's been around for a long time. So the three founders were responding to a contested election in Kenya back in 2007, 2008. So it was an election that was where there was a lot of violence. It wasn't going particularly well, and there was no way for people to share information about what was happening. And so they built the first version of Ushahidi in a weekend just to meet that need. Since then, that product has grown considerably. That community has grown considerably. I think it really came into its own after the earthquake in Haiti, where people were, you know, text messaging that they were trapped in the rubble. They were actually text messaging to Ushahidi, and we were putting that information on a map so that people who were doing humanitarian response could go find them and get them out. Then CrisisNet, something actually, funnily enough, CrisisNet was originally the vision for the Ushahidi platform. It was always intended to be a platform that consumed multiple streams of data and sucked it all in real time and visualized it in a way that people could take action on. But it just, in 2007, 2008, it just wasn't the way that the world shared information hadn't evolved to the point where that was really feasible for an organization of that size. And that's where we're coming in. So we started this project in sort of February, March. Whipped up an MVP, released it in June, and we've been talking about it and taking feedback since then. So the actual implementation of CrisisNet has been over the past 6 months or so, but I know that the project has been incubating obviously for quite some time.
And so, if I understand correctly, that first Ushahidi product, you said you were picking up SMSs and relaying to other people. Sounds like the early vision of Twitter before it became mostly web and specialized client base. Would that be a fair comparison?
Yeah, actually, funnily enough, I was just having that conversation recently where we were talking about our role as an organization and whether we were a humanitarian technology company or just a technology company interested in social good. And I think it really is the latter, just because that, just like you said, that type of product where we were receiving information kind of crowdsourced from different people and putting it into an interface that made it, consumable all at once, was the beginning of Twitter. It was the beginning of Foursquare, kind of a lot of these consumer focused technologies that have evolved. And, we end up focused on where, the problems that we were most compelled to solve, but at a fundamental level, yeah, you're exactly right. It's taking in data and putting it on a map, which, had we been a little bit, had we been a little bit greedier at the time, maybe it would have been Foursquare.
Awesome. I did play around a little bit with the API trial thing, And I notice I can type in search parameters and maybe keyword parameters, and I get back, of course, JSON. So that's why I understand what you said. It's not like a user front end. But could I, in probably, I don't know, a good long weekend, create essentially a great way of displaying that on Google Maps and everything, and just provide the same inputs that you're providing? Is that sort of the level that would be useful to people?
Yeah, that'd be a fantastic way to engage with it. And that's exactly what we've been seeing so far, is that people want to consume the API and then visualize it in a way that makes it a little bit easier to deal with. And I think just that, I think exposing the same search parameters, querying the API, and plotting the results on a Google map would be a great project.
Okay, so this is a challenge to my audience. Go do it this weekend and let me know the results, and I'll forward it on to Jonathan, because that would be just awesome if we had a full working web API just over the weekend. I'm sure somebody's got some time this weekend, so that would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. I would t-shirts for the audience member that solves that problem. We have t-shirts and beer to buy you the next time we're in your city.
And sort of as a follow-up to that, does your API have a JSONP callback?
It's actually you can make cross-domain requests. So we don't implement the JSONP protocol, but we accept requests from any domain as long as you have the appropriate API key. We use the CORS protocol.
Okay, yeah, I just read some stuff recently about that. Okay, that makes more sense. So I'm trying to think if there's more questions from our chat room. I haven't been watching the chat room lately. Let me make sure that we're talking about everything. We're almost out of time, by the way, so I'm just trying to wrap this thing up. Well, I could ask you, so is there anything we haven't talked about yet that you really want to make sure our audience is aware of?
Actually, I think we've really covered it. I mean, I'm excited that we got a chance to talk about Ushahidi as an organization. I'm really glad I got to share the CrisisNet project. I think the open source community is going to be a huge resource. So we talked about this at the beginning. We talked about this massive fire hose of global crisis data, which frankly is ridiculous that there would be one place for all of the crisis data in the world. That, you know, sort of two guys developing this project on their own. I'm sorry. Somebody called me right as we were in the middle of doing our interview. Perfect time.
It happens.
All right. But the point being is that, you know, it's kind of ridiculous to have two people consuming all of the crisis data in the world and putting it into a single platform. And so from the beginning, we've really focused on designing the system so that it was easy for people to contribute. I mean, we love people contributing more sources of data. We love people contributing sort of processing steps to our pipeline. That's really the only way that this kind of system works, is if we're crowdsourcing that data acquisition and manipulation so that people can really get engaged and focus on the data sources and the problems that they're most passionate about, and we can build a community from there. So I'm really glad that we got a chance to talk to your audience. It's the perfect group for engaging with both Ushahidi and CrisisNet.
Actually, I just got whispered in my ear here. Is there what's the future for this? Where is Ushahidi going? Where is CrisisNet in particular going? Do you have some sort of roadmap that's public? And who decides that?
Actually, that's a really good point. Our roadmap isn't public right now, but I think that'd be a great thing to share with the community and get some feedback. The Ushahidi platform, I know that's largely the community is also a big part of discussing that roadmap and sort of discussing features and engaging with some of that feature development even. Ushahidi in general, as an organization, I think it's just bigger and better. We keep incubating new technologies, both things that, you know, we keep in-house and continue to evolve, and things that we spin out. Everything from, there's a huge technology center in Nairobi, the first in that part of Africa called the iHub, which is started as a little co-working space just so that we could get our team together and find a place to work. And that's grown into something much larger than it was originally. I mentioned Brick before, which is another technology that we incubated, and they've spun out. Now they're going the tech startup route, and they've raised some money, and they're shipping routers out all over the world. And so I think for us, both developing these new technologies and engaging with these larger organizations that are just starting to realize the power of technology and the work they're doing, and making sure that they're doing that using the right open source tools in a way that they can, you know, feed back into the community and share their results. Both of those are really important for us as an organization. And then for CrisisNet, like I was saying, I think it's really about taking it to the next level and making sure that the people that have the information and the people that are in a position to make decisions based on what the information tells them, have a way to interact with our platform in a way that's not possible now. So I think building those interfaces so that it's as easy as, you know, drag and drop your data source and then look at the visualization that seems like it either tells the story or gives you the insight that you need. That's really where we're focused over the next few months. And it'd be great to get that kind of feedback from the community.
Cool. And I also have one more request here. You talked about, if I recall correctly, at OSCON, this wonderful project that where people are checking on whether pumps are working by being in the field and then just SMSing to someplace. Can you talk a little bit about that? Recall the story for me?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty much just like you described. So kind of like all of the Ushahidi deployments that we do, the information is, let me take a step back and answer two parts of that question. One, sure. The Ushahidi platform is great at collecting that sort of data. So it's easy to send a text message to our platform and let our system know whether, a water pump is functioning or not. Kind of that basic information that usually sits dormant or sits collected in a place where nobody can really take action on it because it hasn't been collected and visualized in a way that anybody can understand. On the flip side, I talked a little bit about us kind of scratching our own itch and developing that last mile of connectivity with the solution like the brick, that, you know, router that is really designed to connect to anything. And so it's great for taking the Internet of Things and taking things that were never designed to be on the Internet and letting them join the party. So that pump that isn't functioning, maybe there's a sensor on the pump that tells you whether or not it's working appropriately. At the moment, somebody has to go out there, manually check that pump and send a text message to our platform, which is a huge win over not checking it at all or writing it down on the clipboard and letting it sit in their office getting dusty. And I think the next step is removing the need for anybody to check it in the first place because that sensor can communicate with our brick. And so now it's online. And now it can broadcast that message periodically to Ushahidi and really let the person that was spending their time driving out to the pump and checking it every day, spend their time making higher level decisions about the way that their organization should run because, you know, they have access to that data in real time.
And also, again, looking at the Ushahidi homepage, I'm also seeing a couple more projects. You have Edmap and Swift River.
Mm-hmm. So both of those projects, Swift River was a kind of a first pass attempt at doing more with social media. The initial concept for that was that it would consume the fire hose and then it would let you apply a very robust filtering system to that information. So you could whittle Twitter down to a stream that was very specifically focused on a set of keywords or users or hashtags. That product is actually not under active development, but it's still available because it's open source. And we have people that are integrating that into, you know, community response solutions and all sorts of interesting technologies. And then CrowdMap was actually at one point going to be the cloud-hosted version of our Ushahidi platform and evolved into something, I think, even more interesting, where it's focused on letting people tell stories based on their location. And so people have been using that for everything from documenting a trip around the world on a sailboat to organizations that were doing field work and wanted to share the stories of the field work that they were doing in a way that was that felt a little bit more like a social media experience as opposed to the Ushahidi platform, which is very much like a humanitarian data response. It's really geared towards that community, whereas CrowdMap, I think, is just, you know, it's more about the storytelling aspect of that kind of geospatial data.
Cool. And how do people get involved? Where do they go? Who can they talk to? Is there IRC channels? Is there to-do mailing or to-do bug tracking, things like that?
All of the above. We have Ushahidi's on IRC channel. You can find us on GitHub. You can follow all of the projects that almost all of our software projects are public on GitHub, and so you can follow those and contribute and track the repos. You can obviously reach out to us over email. We're on Twitter, at Ushahidi. I'm at Jonathan Morgan. Feel free to chat with me anytime. I'm always excited to talk to developers in the community and find ways to get them involved. So I guess all of the above, where we try to be as accessible as possible. I think we even have a handful of like massive Skype rooms that everybody comes and hangs out in. So we have different parts of our community that just that can message us at any time, just to let us know that they're around and to, you know, pick up interesting things to work on and find ways to get involved.
Very cool. Very cool. Oh, it's just been fascinating talking with you. I mean, when I heard your story at OSCON, I really wanted to make sure that you got on the show, because just the implications, and you've covered so much more about what this all makes possible. This is really, really cool. So thank you for coming on the show, and I really hope somebody will take on my challenge of making the API for you this weekend.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has really been great. I'm like I said, I'm so pumped to be in touch with this community in particular. So I'd love to hear from anybody. If you're working on the project and you get stuck and you have a question, you know, find me on Twitter or send me an email and we'll work it out.
Very cool. Awesome. Very cool. Very cool. Thank you very much. That was Jonathan Morgan, who represents the particularly the crisis.net project, but also works with the rest of the Ushahidi folks, and definitely a humanitarian and a technologist, which I think is an ideal combination for some operations. Dan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant project. I really do. And I think, you know, it's great that the people like Jonathan are working on it. And it's good to see that the kind of solutions that they're coming up with. And he's right that this stuff is growing, and the data is only going to be more and more available. And if we can really make a difference with that kind of data and analyzing it and stuff, then, you know, it could even save lives. It could do all kinds of incredible things that, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we have fun playing with code and stuff, and maybe making, you know, lights flash and circuit boards and stuff, but we can actually make a difference as well. And I think that's just an incredible, incredible thing.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a number of projects. Like, I'm particularly moved by like the MIFOS project that we've had on a couple times in the show, where you're empowering people. You're actually being something that is, it's not just using the technology, like I said, for technology's sake. You're using it to really, you know, bring lots of opportunities and empowerment to people who wouldn't normally have that. And again, that's why when I saw these guys at OSCON, I said, I've got to talk to these guys on our show. So really good. I have to apologize if you can hear a little bit mowing. Apparently in my apartment, it was mowing day. So sorry about the extra noise out there. And that's also why I wasn't on for like half the show, because Dan took over for me, because these mowers have just been, just as soon as the show started, these things started mowing out here. Crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyway, hopefully it hasn't been too annoying for anybody listening at home. We've had worse. We've had that stupid fan at ZipRecruiter and a few other places. So this is great show. Great show. Really glad we got a chance to talk to this guy. Let's look at what's coming up next. We have two things currently on the schedule. If I can bring my schedule up to the right place here. Here's the mower again. There's the mower. Okay. Next week is going to be Skitch. And I apologize to the project leader for calling it Squitch more than once. It has a Q in it. I thought it was like Flickr, where you get rid of the E and still say Flickr, even though you don't say Flickr. You say Flickr. And so I thought this was Squitch, because there was, even though there was no U, the U might have been invisible and silent. Or in a very narrow font. Anyway, Skitch is a database change management application. In fact, the company I'm primarily contracted to right now is about to deploy it. So we'll finally get away from sequentially numbered, apply this to your database to bring it up to speed on your own dev box and things like that. And then speaking of dev boxes, we've got Docker coming immediately after that. There's a lot of interest in Docker. Almost every presentation talked about their relationship with Docker. So it's kind of like we got the lead project guy, whose name unfortunately is not right in front of me, but it's a container manager. So it's the kind of thing, it's sort of like VirtualBox, sort of like you know, other sorts of VMs, but it's thin, so that you can just layer things on top of each other, then build your application on top of that. And you can continue to upgrade the things underneath, and it just sort of merges properly. So looks really cool. Deploys in a very narrow environment. On a native Linux box, you can run the Docker software. And you're not even inside a VM. You're just running on the native Linux platform, which is really cool. Of course, on my Mac, I have to run it at least the first step of a VM. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Q4 is open. I just opened up the dates. I'm starting to send out emails now. So hopefully before we finish with the Docker show, I'll have some more guests bring on. You can go to the homepage for the show is twit.tv/floss. And if you go there, you can see the link to the big spreadsheet that talks about who we're talking to and what dates are still open and all sorts of things like that. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+. And also Floss Weekly on Twitter, if you want to follow that. I bet you could build a Ushahidi instance to follow that and page you every time something comes out on that, I guess. Anyway, we have a live chat, which is very lively today. Number of questions taken from that. We're normally taping at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. And so if you go to live.twit.tv, you can both watch the video and see what, how mistakes we make behind the scenes and also laugh at us a bit. And also there's a chat room there, so you can talk to us directly. And we do talk directly to guests for that. You can follow me at Merlin on Twitter, but that's really just a shadow of my main posts, which are at Google Plus. Randall L. Schwartz. I was just on the reason you'd see me for a couple weeks is I was on a 14-day cruise from Juneau to Anchorage. Seattle to Anchorage. Juneau would be shorter. Seattle to Anchorage. That was a wonderful cruise. Mostly warm, nice and sunny and everything most of the places. And I also had a pre-cruise meetup. A few of you showed up that listened to the show, and I appreciate that. A few Pearl guys from up there as well. And now, not only have I heard noise, I now have the sun in my eyes. So if you're watching the video, if you're not watching the video, you're missing out. There's this nice stripe across my forehead here. So that's all there is for that. No special things coming up. I think I'm going to be at a couple conferences, but I'll tell you about that when we get closer. Dan, what you got going on?
Yeah, I want to mention OggCamp, which is OGGCAMP. It's a strange name. It's not all about Ogg Vorbis and Ogg Theora, just. It's the largest open source event in the UK. We talk about free culture, free software, all kinds of stuff. It's going to be in Oxford this year. And as I'm completely biased because I'm one of the guys who helps to organize it, it's going to be in Oxford in the UK on the 4th and 5th of October, so just under a month. Tickets are still available. There are free tickets available, and you can also make a donation if you choose to, completely optional. We've got great sponsors on board, great speakers, all kinds of stuff. So if you want to find out more, go and check oggcamp.org, oggcamp.org, if you can get to the UK in October. And other than that, you can always find me at danlynch.org, where you can find my blog and Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus and all those things on there, along with other podcasts such as Linux Outlaws and many other things that I do.
You know, this may just be accidental, but the first time you said Oxford, I thought you said Oxford. So I'm thinking Oxford, you'd have a really great shirt, Ogg Camp at Oxford, October.
October, yeah. So well, last year we were going to call it Oktoberfest and have Lederhosen and stuff and call it Oktoberfest, but we didn't quite go that far. But you never know.
Yeah, it's just so Oxford. You could have a shirt that says that.
Oxford.
That'd be cool. Anyway, it's a goofy thing. And the UK people obviously would not ever hear it that way, but we crazy Americans hear whatever we want to hear there. So anyway, cool. Well, Dan, once again, thank you for picking up the other end of this show and also for the extra time you spent asking questions when the mower's been circling like right under my window. So it's just... it's really annoying, and I'm sure you can still hear it in the tracks, maybe, or maybe you can't. I hope not. Anyway, so without further ado, let's go ahead and not get started. Let's go ahead and wrap up the show. We'll see you again next week on Floss Weekly.